I love being an upholder, even though I recognize its pitfalls. My upholderness allowed me to take the steps that led to a clerkship with Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. And when I decided to become a writer, it enabled me to make an enormous career switch. Of course, my upholderness also meant that I spent a lot of time worrying about things like whether a comma should be italicized in a footnote reference to a law journal. For real. Questioners sometimes feel exhausted by their questioning, but they do think everyone should be questioners, because that approach is most rational. Rebels sometimes say they wish they could follow the rules, but they wouldn't want to stop being rebels. Obligers, however, often dislike their tendency. They're vexed by the fact that they can meet others' expectations, but not their expectations for themselves. With the other three tendencies, much of the frustration they create falls on others. Other people may get annoyed by stickler upholders, or interrogator questioners, or maverick rebels, but it's people-pleaser obligers themselves who bear the brunt of the downsides of that tendency. Obligers, in fact, may reach a point of obliger rebellion, a striking pattern in which they abruptly refused to meet an expectation. As one obliger explained, "Sometimes I snap because I get tired of people making assumptions that I'll always do things as expected. It's sort of a rebellious way of asserting myself." Another added, "I work very hard to keep my commitments to other people, but I'll be darned if I can keep a promise to myself. Though every once in a while, I will absolutely refuse to please." They may rebel in symbolic ways, with their hair, clothes, car, and the like. This contrarian streak among obligers explains another pattern I've noticed. Almost always, if a rebel is in a long-term relationship, that rebel is paired with an obliger. Unlike upholders and questioners, who are distressed by the rebel's expectation-rejecting behavior, the obliger enjoys the rebel's refusal to truckle to outward expectations. One rebel explained the dynamics of this combination. "My husband is a big part of how I'm able to look like I function well in the normal adult world. He mails the rent check, which is nice, because I always resent it being due on the same day of every month. He deals with trash day, and moving the car for snow plows, and he makes sure the pescally regular bills are paid on time. I really hate punctuality. Well, when we talk through big decisions, I'm usually the final word." But whatever our tendency, we all share a desire for autonomy. If our feeling of being controlled by others becomes too strong, it can trigger the phenomenon of reactance, a resistance to something that's experienced as a threat to our freedom or our ability to choose. If we're ordered to do something, we may resist it, even if it's something that we might otherwise want to do. I've watched this happen with my daughter, Eliza. If I say, "Why don't you finish your homework? Get it out of the way." She says, "I need a break. I've got to stop." If I say, "You've been working so hard. Why don't you take a break?" She says, "I want to finish." It's easy to see why this impulse creates problems for healthcare professionals, for parents, for teachers, for office managers. The more we push, the more a person may resist. After I gave a talk about the four tendencies, a man asked me, "Which tendency makes people the happiest?" I was startled because that obvious question had never crossed my mind. Also, he continued, with an equally obvious follow-up question, "Which tendency is the most successful?" I didn't have a good response because I'd been so focused on understanding the tendencies that I'd never considered them in comparison to each other. After much reflection, however, I realized that the answer, as it usually is, which I sometimes find annoying, is, it depends. It depends on how a particular person deals with the upside and downside of a tendency. The happiest and most successful people are those who have figured out ways to exploit their tendency to their benefit, and just as important, found ways to counterbalance its limitations. In an interview in the Paris Review, novelist and rebel John Gardner made an observation that I've never forgotten. "Every time you break the law, you pay." And every time you obey the law, you pay. Every action, every habit has its consequences. Upholders, questioners, obligers, and rebels all must grapple with the consequences of fitting in that tendency. I get up at 6 o'clock every morning, and I pay for that. I get more work done, but I also have to go to sleep early. We all must pay, but we can choose that for which we pay. Different solutions for different people. Distinctions. Of course, like all oversimple classifications of this type, the dichotomy becomes, if pressed, artificial, scholastic, and ultimately absurd. But, like all distinctions which embody any degree of truth, it offers a point of view from which to look and compare, a starting point for genuine investigation. Isaiah Berlin, The Hedgehog and the Fox. The Four Tendencies framework had given me a crucial insight into human nature, but there was much that it didn't illuminate. I couldn't yet turn to the more concrete, action-oriented strategies that I was eager to investigate, because I hadn't yet exhausted the possibilities of self-knowledge. As one of the exercises for the Happiness Project I undertook a few years ago, I'd identified my 12 personal commandments, which are the overarching principles by which I want to live my life. My first commandment is to be Gretchen. Yet it's very hard to know myself. I get so distracted by the way I wish I were, or the way I assume I am, that I lose sight of what's actually true. I was slow to understand some of the most basic things about myself. I don't love music. I'm not a big fan of travel. I don't like games. I don't like to shop. I'm not very interested in animals. I like plain food. Why didn't I recognize these aspects of my nature? Partly because I never thought much about it. Doesn't everyone love music? And partly because I expected, based on nothing, that one day I'd outgrow my limitations. I'd learn to love travel, or to appreciate exotic cuisines. Also, I'd assumed that I was pretty much like everyone else, and that everyone else was pretty much like me. That's true, but our differences are very important, and they have a big influence on habit formation. For instance, I kept reading the advice that because our minds are clearest in the morning, we should do our most demanding intellectual work then. I thought I should follow this habit, until finally I realized that my own habit, starting my day with an hour of email grunt work, suits me. I need to clear the decks before I can settle down to serious work. And I suspect that if I'd tried to change my habit, I would have failed. I should tailor my habits to the fundamental aspects of my nature that aren't going to change. It was no use saying, I'll write more every day if I team up with another writer and we race to see who can finish writing a book faster, because I don't like competition. To avoid wasting my precious habit formation energy on dead ends, I need to shape my habits to suit me. For this reason, I developed a list of questions to highlight aspects of my nature that are relevant to habit formation. They say the world is made up of two types of people, those who divide the world into two types of people and those who don't. I'm clearly in the former category. Am I a lark or an owl? Research shows that morning people, or larks, really do differ from night people, or owls. Most people fit somewhere in between, but the extremes, the two chronotypes as measured by their sleep midpoint, do exist. The two types are more productive and energetic at different points in the day. I'm a lark. I go to sleep and wake on the early side. Owls do just the opposite. I used to believe that owls could become larks if they made an effort to go to sleep earlier. But research suggests that this attribute is hardwired. Genes play a big role, as does age. Young children tend to be larkish. Adolescents tend to be owls, with a peak at age 19 and a half for women and age 21 for men. Older adults tend to be larks. Interestingly, research suggests that larks are likely to be happier, healthier, and more satisfied with life than owls. in part because the world favors larks. Owls fall asleep later than larks do, and because work, school, and young children start early, owls get less sleep, which makes their lives harder. Larks, owls, and everyone in between should consider that aspect of their nature when trying to shape a habit. An owl shouldn't bother trying to form the habit of getting up early to study, and a lark shouldn't try to fit in 2 hours of writing after dinner. Sometimes we may not recognize our own type. A friend told me, "I went on a meditation retreat where we woke up at 4. It was like a switch flipped for me, and my life became so much better. Now I go to bed around 9 or 9:30, and I wake up at 4. I love it." Am I a marathoner, a sprinter, or a procrastinator? Especially for workplace habits, it's key to distinguish the pace at which people prefer to work. I'm a marathoner. I like to work at a slow and steady clip, and I dislike deadlines. In fact, I often finish work early. In law school, I had 2 massive writing requirements to complete by graduation, and I wrote them both by the end of my first year. Side note, perhaps my eagerness to write big papers was a sign that I wanted to be a writer instead of a lawyer, but that's another issue. Working on projects steadily over long periods of time ignites my creativity. By contrast, sprinters prefer to work in quick bursts of intense effort, and they deliberately wait for the pressure of a deadline to sharpen their thinking. A sprinter told me, "I never prepare a speech until the people are in their seats and I'm heading to the podium. It drives my staff crazy, but that's when I get my ideas." Another sprinter observed, "I prefer to be completely immersed in a project for a short period of time. The work flows better, I can hold my concentration. Spread things out, and the total hours go way up." Sprinters and marathoners usually feel good about their work style, but procrastinators don't. Procrastinators may resemble sprinters because they too tend to finish only when they're against a deadline, but the two types are quite different. Sprinters choose to work at the last minute because the pressure of a deadline clarifies their thoughts. Procrastinators hate last-minute pressure and wish they could force themselves to work before the deadline looms. Unlike sprinters, procrastinators often agonize about the work they're not doing, which makes it hard for them to do anything fun or meaningful with their time. They may rush around doing busy work as a way to avoid doing what they know they have to do. It's a secret of adulthood. Working is one of the most dangerous forms of procrastination. Sprinters call marathoners plodding, and marathoners call sprinters irresponsible, but there's no right way. Procrastinators, however, are happier when they change their work habits to work more steadily. Am I an underbuyer or an overbuyer? Underbuyers hate to shop and buy. Overbuyers love to shop and buy. As a confirmed underbuyer, I delay making purchases or buy as little as possible. I scramble to buy items like a winter coat or a bathing suit after the point when I need them. I'm suspicious of buying things with very specific uses. Suit bags, hand cream, hair conditioner, rain boots, Kleenex. I often consider buying an item, then decide, I'll get it some other time. Or maybe I don't really need it. Because we underbuyers dislike buying, we often resist buying equipment or services that would help us keep our good habits. Overbuyers, by contrast, find excuses to buy. They accumulate large quantities of office supplies or kitchen gadgets or travel paraphernalia with the thought, this will probably come in handy someday. When trying to shape a habit, overbuyers tend to load up on equipment or services that they imagine will help them keep their good habits. The underbuyer thinks, I don't need to buy running shoes. These old tennis shoes will be fine. The overbuyer thinks, I need running shoes and a spare pair and a reflector vest and a pedometer and a book about avoiding injury. Knowing our inclination to under or overbuy can help us identify opportunities to buy or not buy to foster our healthy habits. Underbuyers should remember that spending money to support a good habit is worthwhile. Overbuyers should remember that mere acquisition isn't enough to establish a good habit. Am I a simplicity lover or an abundance lover? As an ardent fan of children's literature, I've started 3 children's literature reading groups. Yes, 3. When I started the first group, I truly believed that I was the only adult in New York City who loved children's and YA literature. At one of our meetings, a friend remarked, "I always want to feel empty." And another responded, "I always want to feel full." This was one of the most interesting brief exchanges I'd ever heard. I didn't understand exactly what these 2 people meant, but it got me thinking about those who love simplicity and those who love abundance. Simplicity lovers are attracted by the idea of less, of emptiness, bare surfaces and shelves, few choices, a roomy closet. I'm in this camp. I get more pleasure out of shedding things than from acquiring things. I easily feel overwhelmed when there's too much noise, too much stuff, or too much happening at once. Abundance lovers are attracted by the idea of more, of overflow, of addition, of ampleness, of a full pantry. They always want to have more than enough. They like a bit of bustle, and they enjoy collecting things and having a wide array of choices. Simplicity lovers and abundance lovers thrive in different environments. For instance, a simplicity lover is likely to work better in an office that's quiet, with minimal decoration. The abundance lover, in an office that's lively and crammed with visual details. I visited a tech company that had just held a Decorate Your Team's Cubicle Pod contest, and stuff was everywhere, even hanging from the ceiling. I'm sure the contest was fun, but I thought to myself, I could never work here. When changing habits, a simplicity lover may be attracted to elimination and simplification, to saving money by cutting off cable TV or quitting online shopping. An abundance lover may be attracted to addition and variety, to making money by starting a freelance career or learning how to invest. Am I a finisher or an opener? Some people love finishing, and some people love opening, both literally and figuratively. Finishers love the feeling of bringing a project to completion, and they're determined to use the last drop in the shampoo bottle. Openers thrill to the excitement of launching a new project and find pleasure in opening a fresh tube of toothpaste. I'm a finisher. Jamie is an opener. The other day, I looked inside a kitchen cabinet and saw 4 bags of granola, all open. When I pointed this out to Jamie and demanded that he not open another bag until those were finished, he just laughed, and for the next few weeks, he amused himself by pretending to open more bags in front of me. As a finisher, I get a sense of accomplishment when I use the last egg in a carton, and I feel a weird satisfaction when something breaks or wears out. I wondered why I like to see the stuffing peek out of our sofa or the hole in an old pair of socks until I realized that it's my finisher nature, delighting in the finish. By contrast, an opener law professor told me, "I'm constantly starting new articles or writing proposals for new courses. I have a stack of drafts that I've never bothered to polish into finished pieces. Plus, I always have several open jars of mustard in the fridge." If we know whether we're a finisher or an opener, we can shape our habits to suit that preference. For instance, when I was trying to form the habit of blogging regularly, I created 1 blog where I post 6 days a week. When I've posted for the day, I'm finished. An opener acquaintance has bought more than 300 URLs, maintains 12 sites, and is always considering launching a new site. That suits his desire for opening. I like my strength training gym. I lift weights for 20 minutes. Then I'm finished. There's not 1 more thing I can do. Openers might prefer a gym that allows them to rotate through many types of exercise. Because finishers focus on their ability to complete, they may be overly cautious about trying to form new habits. Openers may be overly optimistic about their ability to take on additional habits. Am I a familiarity lover or a novelty lover? Some people love familiarity. Some love novelty. I'm definitely in the familiarity camp. I love to reread my favorite books and to watch movies over and over. I eat the same foods, more or less, every day. I like returning to places I've visited before. Other people thrive on doing new things. For familiarity lovers, a habit becomes easier as it becomes familiar. When I felt intimidated by the library when I started law school, I made myself walk through it a few times each day until I felt comfortable enough to work there. When I started blogging, my unfamiliarity with the mechanics of posting made me dread it. But I forced myself to post every day so that the foreign became familiar and the difficult became automatic. Novelty lovers may embrace habits more readily when they seem less habit-like. A guy told me, "I feel stale when I go to work every day and see the same faces all the time. So once a week, I work in a different satellite office to shake things up." In fact, novelty lovers may do better with a series of short-term activities, 30-day challenges, for instance, instead of trying to create an enduring, automatic habit. One reader commented, "I love planning routines and planning to create habits as if it's going to work. But the follow-through is rarely there, almost as if I have some inner repulsion to doing the same things in the same way. On the other hand, the buzz I get from trying new things is brilliant." Am I promotion-focused or prevention-focused? In their thought-provoking book, Focus, researchers Tori Higgins and Heidi Grant Halverson argue that people lean toward being promotion-focused or prevention-focused in their aims. Promotion-focused people concentrate on achievement and advancement, on making gains, on getting more love, praise, pleasure. They eagerly and optimistically pursue their goals. By contrast, prevention-focused people concentrate on fulfilling their duties, on avoiding losses, and on minimizing danger, pain, or censure. They're vigilant against possible drawbacks or problems. A good habit and a bad habit are the mirror images of each other. A person might want to quit eating junk food, or eat better, or to get more sleep, or stop staying up too late. A promotion-focused person recycles in order to make the environment cleaner. A prevention-focused person recycles in order to avoid getting a fine. Different arguments resonate with different people, and it's helpful to frame a habit in the way that suits each individual. Do I like to take small steps or big steps? Many people have better success adopting a habit when they start with modest, manageable steps. A series of minor but real accomplishments gives people the confidence to continue. In what influential behavior researcher BJ Fogg calls tiny habits, a person may begin a habit by doing a single sit-up or reading one page, and by taking these tiny steps, start on a path toward keeping that habit. The slow accumulation of small triumphs is encouraging and very sustainable. Keeping changes modest can make it easier to stick to a new habit and to avoid the burnout that can hit when we try to make big changes all at once. Also, by taking little steps, we gradually become accustomed to including a new habit in the pattern of our days. The habit of the habit is even more valuable than the habit itself. For instance, the habit of tracking expenses each day is more valuable than any one particular calculation. Keeping a habit in the smallest way protects and strengthens it. I write every day, even just a sentence, to keep my habit of daily writing strong. In high school, when I was trying to acquire the habit of running, I ran down the block until I'd passed 3 houses. Then I turned back. After a few runs like that, I ran past 4 houses. Over time, I worked up to a few miles. By taking small, manageable steps, I managed to stick with running long enough to turn it into a habit. Nevertheless, it's also true that some people do better when they're very ambitious. Sometimes, counterintuitively, it's easier to make a major change than a minor change. If a habit changes very gradually, we may lose interest, give way under stress, or dismiss the change as insignificant. A big transformation generates an energy and excitement that helps to foster habits. As Steve Jobs reflected, "I have a great respect for incremental improvement, and I've done that sort of thing in my life, but I've always been attracted to the more revolutionary changes. I don't know why." Along the same lines, my college roommate's motto was, "Do everything all at once." A reader quoted a phrase from James Collins and Jerry Porras' book, Built to Last. BHAG, big, hairy, audacious goals, all the way. I resisted this for years, thinking that to shoot too high only meant I would fail. What I didn't realize was that shooting high motivated me much more. Sometimes a single unexpected question can illuminate a hidden aspect of my life. A question like, "Do you tend to blame other people or do you blame yourself?" can give me a fresh perspective on myself. So, in addition to identifying big personality distinctions, I came up with a list of short, straightforward questions to help me know myself better, so I could better tailor my habits to my nature. How I like to spend my time. At what time of day do I feel energized? When do I drag? Do I like racing from one activity to another, or do I prefer unhurried transitions? What activities take up my time, but aren't particularly useful or stimulating? Would I like to spend more time with friends or by myself? Do I have several things on my calendar that I anticipate with pleasure? What can I do for hours without feeling bored? What daily or weekly activity did I do for fun when I was 10 years old? What I value. What's most satisfying to me? Saving time, or money, or effort? Does it bother me to act differently from other people, or do I get a charge out of it? Do I spend a lot of time on something that's important to someone else, but not to me? If I had $500 that I had to spend on fun, how would I spend it? Do I like to listen to experts, or do I prefer to figure things out for myself? Does spending money on an activity make me feel more committed to it or less committed? Would I be happy to see my children have the life I've had? My current habits. Am I more likely to indulge in a bad habit in a group or when I'm alone? If I could magically, effortlessly change one habit in my life, what would it be? If the people around me could change one of my habits, what would they choose? Of my existing habits, which would I like to see my children adopt or not? It wasn't until I asked myself, "Do I have several things on my calendar that I anticipate with pleasure?" that I realized my book groups played a crucial role in helping me to keep fun habits. In one book group, we read adult fiction, and in the other three, we read children's or young adult books. And my belonging to these groups helps me enforce several valuable habits. It boosts my habit of reading, Essential 7 number 4, Rest, Relax, and Enjoy. It helps me to read new books instead of rereading old favorites, which is often my inclination, Essential 7 number 5, Accomplish More. And it means I meet new people and make regular plans with friends, Essential 7 number 7, Engage More Deeply in Relationships. People often ask, what are the best habits to follow? As though there's one path that everyone should follow. Debate rages about which habits are most likely to foster creativity and productivity. Yet the book Daily Rituals, Mason Curry's exhaustive examination of the work habits of 161 writers, composers, artists, scientists, and philosophers, makes one thing clear. While these brilliant people vary tremendously in the specific habits they follow, they all know very well what habits work for them, and they make a great effort to maintain those habits. Some have the habit of getting an early start, like Haruki Murakami, or working late into the night, like Tom Stoppard, of living a life of quiet predictability, like Charles Darwin, or of boozy revelry, like Toulouse-Lautrec, of procrastinating endlessly, like William James, or working regular hours, like Anthony Trollope, of working in silence, like Gustav Mahler, or of working amid a bustle of activity, like Jane Austen, of drinking a lot of alcohol, like Friedrich Schiller, or drinking a lot of coffee, like Kierkegaard, of producing work for many hours a day, like H.L. Mencken, or for just 30 minutes a day, like Gertrude Stein. There's no magic formula, not for ourselves and not for the people around us. We won't make ourselves more creative and productive by copying other people's habits, even the habits of geniuses. We must know our own nature and what habits serve us best. Pillars of habits. Many strategies help us change our habits, and four strategies tower above the others: monitoring, foundation, scheduling, and accountability. They're so ubiquitous and familiar that it's easy to take them for granted, but they're invaluable. To make the most of the indispensable pillars of habits, we must take into account what we've learned about ourselves from the exercises in self-knowledge. For instance, the strategy of scheduling works for most people, but not for rebels. The strategy of accountability works for most people, and it's essential for obligers. The strategies build on each other. We manage what we monitor. Monitoring. All our life, so far as it has definite form, is but a mass of habits, practical, emotional, and intellectual, systematically organized for our weal or woe and bearing us irresistibly toward our destiny. William James talks to teachers and students. The strategy of monitoring has an uncanny power. It doesn't require change, but it often leads to change. To paraphrase a business school truism, we manage what we monitor, and keeping close track of our actions means we do better in categories such as eating, drinking, exercising, working, TV and internet use, spending, and just about anything else. Self-measurement brings self-awareness, and self-awareness strengthens our self-control. Something as simple as a roadside speed display to show motorists how fast they're going helps them to slow down. A key step for the strategy of monitoring is to identify precisely what action is monitored. Specific habits such as read the news every morning or call one client each day are easy to monitor, while vague resolutions such as be more informed or cultivate better client relationships are hard to monitor. I was reminded of Lord Kelvin's observation, overbroad, but nevertheless thought-provoking. When you cannot express it in number, your knowledge is of a meager and unsatisfactory kind. If we want something to count in our lives, we should figure out a way to count it. Actual measurement is crucial, because when we guess what we're doing, we're often wildly inaccurate. Unsurprisingly, we tend to underestimate how much we eat and overestimate how much we exercise. In one study, people estimated that in the course of daily activities, excluding exercise regimens, they walked about 4 miles. In fact, most walked less than 2 miles. Accurate monitoring helps determine whether a habit is worth the time, money, or energy it consumes. A friend tracked his TV watching because he wanted to know if TV was eating up too much of his day. It was. I read about a woman who quit drinking because she figured that in 6 years, she and her husband had spent almost $30,000 on alcohol, money they would have preferred to spend on something else. Aaron Beck, founder of cognitive behavioral therapy, maintains that people find it easy to notice what their partners do wrong, but not what they do right. So he suggests keeping marriage diaries to track partners' considerate behavior. One study showed that 70% of couples who did this tracking reported an improved relationship. People who love to self-monitor can join the Quantified Self movement, a community of those who use technology to track every aspect of their daily life and performance. But most of us aren't ready to make quite such a commitment to the process. Monitoring is valuable, but it's also time-consuming and a bit tiresome, so I monitor only the aspects of my life that really matter. I decided I needed to have a long talk with my sister Elizabeth about the strategy of monitoring. To my continual regret, Elizabeth lives far away. Los Angeles is a long flight from New York City, which means we don't often see each other, and there's a big time difference, which makes it hard to talk by phone. But one day I was determined to track her down, because I knew she'd have interesting insights about monitoring. Elizabeth has type 1 diabetes, which means that her pancreas doesn't produce enough insulin. In type 2 diabetes, which is far more common, the body produces insulin, but doesn't react properly to it. Without insulin, blood sugar can spike to dangerous, even life-threatening levels, so Elizabeth must give herself multiple daily insulin injections. And to inject herself correctly, she must know her blood sugar level. For years, she'd tested her blood sugar by pricking her finger to check her blood, but she'd recently gotten a device inserted under her skin to monitor her blood sugar continuously. I wanted to know if she found the monitor effective. "Monitoring is key," she said. "For years, I hated the idea of having a device attached to my stomach, but with diabetes, accurate tracking is so important that I finally caved. Now I can't imagine not having the monitor." When she told me she was getting the device, I'd imagined that it might administer insulin directly or tell her what she needed. Nope. The monitor merely provides a continuous record of her blood sugar levels, but that information makes a big difference. Without a monitor, I might test my blood sugar 10 times a day, but the monitor checks it constantly, she explained. I know where my blood sugar is and where it's heading. Also, I know the effect of what I'm doing, so I can't kid myself. Like, I was eating this frozen yogurt that claimed to be low carb, but from the readings I got on my monitor, I know that can't be true. Even though the monitor doesn't actually do anything, seeing the numbers makes you behave differently, I asked her. For sure. Without a monitor, if I ate something questionable, I might unconsciously wait a few hours to test, so I'd get a better number. But that doesn't work with a monitor. I can't fool myself. That's why the strategy of monitoring works so well. No more fooling ourselves. I decided to exploit it for my own habits. If I had a better handle on what I was doing, I could focus my habit formation energy in the right place. I suspected that in certain areas, I was giving myself more credit for good habits than I deserved. First up, I addressed eating and exercise. I care a lot about eating and exercise. Partly for health, partly out of vanity. It's funny, I've noticed that many people focus mostly on one aspect of their appearance. A bald spot, wrinkles, a paunch, a bad hair day, and don't worry much about anything else. That's certainly true for me. I've always been focused on my weight. I'm not alone in this concern about weight, of course. Eat and drink more healthfully is one of the essential 7, and while there are many good reasons to eat and drink more healthfully, weight loss is one of the most important. As of 2010, 70% of Americans were overweight or obese, which increases risk of coronary heart disease, high blood pressure, stroke, type 2 diabetes, cancer, and sleep apnea, among other things. And it's not just about physical health. I felt sad when I overheard a woman at a conference say, "I was asked to give a TED talk, but I thought, I can't do it. I'm not at a good weight right now." Until well after college, I considered myself overweight. Not so overweight that it affected my health, but enough that it affected my self-image, and my weight really bothered me. Finally, I managed to get to a number where I felt more at ease, and it's been a huge relief to feel comfortable with my size. This measure of ease still seems new, however, and my desire not to gain weight shapes many of my habits. I try very hard to make healthy food choices, and I exercise fairly regularly, though not very vigorously. Still, I could be doing better, and like just about most people, I love the idea of painlessly dropping a few pounds. I wondered if monitoring would help. For people who want to eat and drink more healthfully, keeping a food journal can be extremely effective. For instance, one study showed that dieters who kept a food journal 6 or 7 days a week lost twice as much weight as people who did so once a week or not at all. Although keeping a food journal sounds straightforward, I braced myself for a challenge when I decided to try it. No one ever mentions how hard it is to keep a food journal, but I'd already tried and failed 3 times. Along the same lines, I tried before to use a pedometer to count my steps. According to a 2003 study, Americans, on average, walked 5,117 steps each day, half of what's recommended. Research shows that wearing a pedometer and trying to hit a goal does make people more physically active. And when I'd worn a pedometer in the past, I definitely walked more. I'm the type who really relishes getting credit for every step I take. I'd eventually stopped wearing my pedometer, though, because it often fell off, once into the toilet, and it looked ugly. As I was considering various methods to track my eating and exercise, I read a New York Times article about the Jawbone Up Band, and I decided to try it. I'd wear a wristband to track my steps and my sleep, and sync the band to my phone through the headphone jack. I'd use my phone to read my results and to record the food that I ate. But when the package arrived in the mail, my enthusiasm waned. As I lifted the small black and silver band out of its plastic case, I realized that I'd acquired yet another gadget to learn to use to keep updated and charged. And more cords. I'd better be more careful with this cap, I thought, as I dropped the little piece of plastic onto the floor. However, although I'd expected to find it onerous to sync the wristband to my phone twice a day, by the second day I was sinking away because I loved watching my activity numbers rise. Walking a mile requires about 2,000 steps, and I aim to walk 10,000 steps each day. While research suggests that taking 10,000 steps does reduce obesity and heart disease, there's no particular evidence for 10,000 as opposed to 8,000 or 12,000, but 10,000 was a satisfying number, so I stuck with it. The Up Band also helped me do a much better job of food tracking than I'd ever done with my little notebook. In a surprisingly short period, I started to feel uneasy until I'd recorded food in my log. I'd think, it's too much trouble to go get my phone now, I'll add this yogurt later. But before long, I was hunting for my phone whenever I ate something. As I tracked, I noticed several aspects of eating that make monitoring difficult. For one thing, it's often surprisingly hard to gauge servings. We're poor judges of how much we're eating, and studies suggest that we can eat servings that are about 20% bigger or smaller than a serving size without realizing it. Also, in what's called unit bias, we tend to finish a serving if it seems like a natural portion of one, and we tend to take one serving no matter what the size. In a study where people could help themselves to big pretzels, people took one. When people were instead offered big pretzels cut in half, they took one half pretzel. Also, eating directly from the container makes it impossible to monitor how much we're eating. Whether the product is candy or shampoo or cat food, the bigger the package, the more people use. In what seems like an aspect of the same principle, I've noticed that I finish books faster when I have a bigger stack from the library. Taking bites while cooking, eating off plates, sharing food, or eating food served in multiple bite-sized servings, dim sum, tapas, hors d'oeuvres, petit fours, appetizers ordered for the table, also makes it hard to track consumption accurately, which is likely part of their appeal. One way to monitor is to save the evidence left behind. The pile of bones, the peanut shells, the candy wrappers, the day's coffee cups or soda cans or beer bottles. Context matters too. One study of package design showed that people avoid the smallest and largest beverage sizes. Therefore, if the smallest drink size is dropped, or a larger drink size is added, such as the Starbucks Trenta, people adjust their choices upward. As the weeks wore on, along with keeping a food journal, I added a new monitoring habit. No seconds. When people pre-plate their food and eat just one helping, they eat about 14% less than when they take smaller servings and return for more helpings. I'd often pull this trick myself. I'd give myself a small serving, then go back for more. The need to monitor exactly what I'd eaten in order to record it forced me to stop this little game. As part of the strategy of monitoring, I decided to buy a digital scale to weigh myself. Although some experts advise people to weigh themselves just once a week to avoid becoming discouraged by natural fluctuations, current research suggests that weighing each day, which may strike some people as excessive, is associated with losing weight and keeping it off. Until now, I'd only weighed myself when I went to my cardio gym, but now I wanted to get serious about monitoring. Side note, people weigh their highest on Sunday, their lowest on Friday morning. I'd wanted to buy a scale for more than a year, but I put it off because of my daughter, Eliza. Eliza is very easygoing, and although she spends a lot of time choosing her outfits, changing the color of her nail polish, and trying to grow her long brown hair still longer, she isn't preoccupied with her weight or any particular body part. Nevertheless, plunking down a scale in the bathroom that she shares with Jamie and me seemed like exactly the wrong message to send to a 13-year-old girl. One of my personal commandments is to identify the problem. What was the problem? I want a digital scale, but I don't want Eliza to see it. Solution: I bought the scale and put it in a little used closet where she'd probably never find it. People find other ways to monitor their bodies. A friend has a pair of jeans that she never wears except to pull them on to see whether they're tighter or looser than before. For myself, I'm much happier relying on my digital scale than on form-fitting clothes. Most days, I wear yoga pants and a hoodie, the point of which is that they're delightfully stretchy and non-confining. When I first started to use the Up Band, I ignored its mood monitoring and sleep monitoring functions. Perhaps surprisingly, for someone who's preoccupied with happiness, I had no interest in tracking my moods. As for sleep, I was a sleep zealot, so I didn't think I needed to monitor it. Sleep, as I remind anyone who gives me the opportunity, is crucial for good mental and physical health and a critical time for bodily repair and regulation. Lack of sleep negatively affects mood, memory, immune function, and pain sensitivity. It makes people more likely to fight with their partners. It contributes to weight gain. Lack of sleep also leads to dithering. Procrastination expert Piers Steele reports that being too tired is the most common reason people give for procrastination. One study estimated that for every hour of interrupted sleep during the previous night, people wasted 8.4 minutes in online puttering, checking email, internet surfing, and the like. And while many people claim, "I've trained myself to get by with 5 hours," and say they don't feel particularly sleepy, research shows that the chronically sleep-deprived are quite impaired. Yet many adults routinely sleep less than 7 hours. On a flight to San Francisco, I saw with my own eyes the evidence of people's sleep deprivation. At midday, many passengers were fast asleep, not dozing, completely zonked out. I mentioned this to a friend, and he bragged, "Oh, I always sleep on planes. I can fall asleep anywhere, anytime." "Maybe you're chronically underslept," I suggested. It took all my strength not to launch into a lecture on the importance of sleep. "No, I'm not," he said. "I've learned to adjust to very little sleep." "If you sit still for 10 minutes in a quiet room," I asked, "can you fall asleep?" "Yes." "Are you dragged out of a sound sleep by the alarm every morning?" "Is there any other way to wake up?" he asked. "Do you depend on caffeine and sugar to give you energy spikes?" "Sure." "Do you feel too tired at night to do anything but watch TV or surf the internet?" "What else would I do?" "Do you binge sleep on the weekends by sleeping in very late or taking lots of naps?" "Of course." He didn't mind being sleep deprived, but I needed my 7 hours, and I fought to protect my sleep time against any encroachment. Or so I thought, until I decided to use the Up Band's sleep tracking function. Or try to use it. Some nights I forgot to press the button to start the sleep tracker. Finally, instead of trying to remember, I piggybacked this new habit onto my old habit of setting my alarm. To my dismay, the Up Band revealed that even an avowed sleep nut like me often stayed up too late. I'd fallen into a classic failure to monitor trap. Because I felt smug about my good sleep habits, I remembered the nights when I went to bed at 9:45, but overlooked the nights when I stayed up until 11:30 or later. Once monitoring showed that I wasn't getting enough sleep, I decided to give myself a specific bedtime. Every night, if I was at home, I'd aim to be in bed by 10:30. Now, every night at 10:30, I tell myself, it's my bedtime. And if I'm still up at 11 o'clock, I say, it's 30 minutes past my bedtime. Using a clear rule instead of feeling sleepy helps, because too often I get into that restless, wired but tired state that tricks me into thinking that I'm not ready for bed when I'm actually exhausted. In addition to tracking these health habits, I wanted to deploy the strategy of monitoring in the important area of time. I know that if I don't measure certain values in my life, I neglect them. I decided to track how much time I spent reading. Reading is both my cubicle and my playground, and it's my favorite thing to do. If I'm honest with myself, it's practically the only pastime I really enjoy. I'm not a very well-rounded person. For the last few years, however, it seemed as though I never did any reading. Objectively, this couldn't be true. I checked books out of the library and returned them after I'd finished them. I bought books and put them on the shelf, read. I took notes on my reading, yet I had no idea when I found time to read. When did I read? My friend Laura Vanderkam, a time management expert, emphasizes the power of tracking time use, so I decided to try that. I made a daily time log, a simple grid with the days of the week mapped against the hours of the day in 30-minute increments. The log could be used to track any activity, but I plan to record my reading time. Or maybe not. After a few days, I admitted defeat. Many people find the time log to be an invaluable tool, but I just could not use it. The paper was never in the right place, or I kept forgetting to enter my reading time. I disliked the idea of getting more dependent on my phone. After all, I still rely on my ancient Filofax. But I was already using my phone to monitor, so I decided to use it to monitor my reading, too. After some cursory research into time-tracking apps, secret of adulthood, most decisions don't require extensive research, I downloaded the TimeJot app. I couldn't get myself to use it. Next, Hours Tracker. No luck. I just couldn't get in the habit of recording my reading time. And the more I tried, the more annoyed I got. This attempted habit wasn't doing any good, so I junked it. However, even this failed attempt to monitor made me more aware of my desire to read. So, although I can't point to a time log to prove that I'm reading more, I'm pretty sure that I am. I considered monitoring spending as well. People aren't very good at tracking their expenditures. In one study, when 30 people were asked to estimate the amount on their credit card bill, every person underestimated that number by an average of almost 30%. For many people, credit cards are themselves an obstacle to accurate monitoring of spending, because while handing over a wad of cash makes spending seem vividly real, using a charge card makes parting with money easier. The same principle of disguised expenditure explains why casinos require that gamblers play with chips, not bills, and why it's easy to overspend in a foreign country, where money looks as if it came from a board game. For some people, however, plastic works better than cash. A reader noted, "When I get cash, it always seems to disappear quickly, and I have little idea how it was spent. I buy almost everything with one credit card. I log into my account online regularly, and I can see what I've bought and how much I've spent." In the end, however, I decided not to monitor my spending. Monitoring is a powerful tool, and it would probably give me valuable insights into how Jamie and I spend money. But my spending was well under control. In fact, as an underbuyer, I often need to prod myself to buy. For instance, my family is perpetually short of mittens and gloves. Since monitoring takes time and energy, I decided that monitoring expenditures would only sap the energy I needed for monitoring the aspects of my life that I truly want to track. As I talk to people about how they monitor themselves, the potentially dangerous concept of moderation kept cropping up. Framing a level of activity or consumption as moderate can be misleading, because while the word moderation implies reasonableness and restraint, it's actually a relative term. Moderate, in comparison, to what? 200 years ago, Americans ate less than a fifth of the sugar we eat today. So a moderate amount of sugar by today's standards could be considered excessive by historical standards. Monitoring requires us to make an actual reckoning, which defeats the comfortable fuzziness of moderation. As I'd hoped, monitoring was having a good effect on my habits. Even before applying more active habit strategies, I'd noticed myself making small shifts as the data provided by tracking helped nudge me to do better than before. Also, I enjoyed monitoring. As an upholder, I like watching my progress and getting credit for my accomplishments, and in some situations, I didn't mind the grunt work of tracking. Monitoring tends to appeal to questioners, too, because they love getting information and using it to shape their habits. From what I've observed, however, obligers may struggle to monitor unless someone is checking on them. Just wearing an up band might not supply enough external accountability for some obligers, but activating the team feature to allow other people to check their stats might help. Rebels? It depends on whether rebels want to monitor. My biggest monitoring challenge was my urge to monitor myself selectively, because it's tempting to record only my virtuous moments. On the other hand, when I feel as though I haven't made much progress, monitoring is a reminder of what I have accomplished. Progress, not perfection, is the goal. I'm a gold star junkie, and I love scrolling back on my up report to see that I exceeded my 10,000 step goal. But I also know that 5,000 steps are better than 1,000. A secret of adulthood, cribbed from Voltaire, is don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Monitoring makes it possible to remember everything I've accomplished. At times, I did find that my monitoring distracted me from my own experience, and perhaps kept me from encountering it as deeply as I might have done if I hadn't been monitoring. If I'm fussing with the sleep function on my up band, I may not notice how good it feels to stretch out in bed. Nonetheless, monitoring is invaluable because it helps ensure that I get to bed. How will I get a good night's sleep if I stay glued to my computer until midnight? By monitoring the activities that I want to foster, I get an accurate picture of what I'm doing, which helps me see what I want to do differently. My sister, Elizabeth, had decided that knowing her blood sugar level was so important that she had to monitor it as closely as possible. I wasn't monitoring anything nearly as vital, of course, but the same principle applied. I should monitor whatever is essential to me. In that way, I ensure that my life reflects my values. First things first. Foundation. Habits gradually change the face of one's life as time changes one's physical face, and one does not know it. Virginia Woolf, Diary, April 13, 1929. The observational strategies of four tendencies, distinctions, and monitoring take their power from self-awareness. Because I tend to gravitate towards the concrete, I was eager to get out of my own head to start acting on what I'd learned. I'd begin by working on the strategy of foundation, because I'd have an easier time fostering good habits if my foundation was strong. While some experts advise focusing on one habit project at a time to avoid draining willpower, others note that people who work on one positive habit often find it easier to improve in other areas. For instance, people who stick to a program of exercise also show better health and work-related behaviors. Maybe that's one reason why so many major religions have periods of ritualized self-denial, like Lent, Ramadan, and Yom Kippur. Self-command breeds self-command, and change fosters change. The reverse is true, too. Undesirable habits often cluster together and reinforce each other. If we want to improve our habits, where should we begin? I often remind myself, first things first. That is, begin by addressing big, obvious problems. Surprisingly often, When people want to improve their habits, they begin with a habit that won't deliver much payoff in return for the habit formation energy required. I knew a guy who was chronically sleep-deprived, never exercised, could never find his keys or his wallet, was constantly late for work,